Introduction to the World is Flat, version 3.0. Why go through all the trouble of writing a second, expanded, and updated version of The World is Flat only a year after the first expanded version was published and a mere 2 years after the original? I can offer a very brief answer. Because I could, and because I had to. Precisely because of the powerful technological forces detailed in this book, the publishing industry has sped up, and it is now possible to revamp a whole book relatively easily. That is what I mean when I say I could. The reason I must do it is fourfold. First, the forces flattening the world didn't stop when the first edition of this book was published in April 2005. And I wanted to keep tracking them and weaving them into my overall thesis. Second, I wanted to answer one of the questions I was asked most often by parents while I was traveling around the country to speak about the book. Okay, Mr. Friedman, thank you for telling us that the world is flat. Now, what do I tell my kids? In the 2.0 edition, I added a lot more material on the subject of what is the right education to access the new middle-class jobs, and I have added still more in this 3.0 edition. Third, I found many of the comments from readers and reviewers both thoughtful and useful, and I wanted to absorb some of the best of them into the book. And finally, in this 3.0 edition, I have added two new chapters to deal with themes related to the flat world that were not apparent to me before, but now seem extremely important. One deals with how to be a political activist and social entrepreneur in a flat world. The other deals with a more troubling phenomenon, how we manage our reputations in a world where we are all becoming publishers and therefore all becoming public figures. This book has triggered a cottage industry of articles with variations on the title, The World is Not Flat. I have two reactions to these. One, no kidding. Two, whenever you opt for a big metaphor like, the world is flat, you trade a certain degree of academic precision for a much larger degree of explanatory power. Of course, the world is not flat, but it isn't round anymore either. I have found that using the simple notion of flatness to describe how more people can plug, play, compete, connect, and collaborate with more equal power than ever before, which is what is happening in the world, really helps people who are trying to understand the essential impact of all the technological changes coming together today. Not only do I make no apologies for it, I think that with every passing year, it becomes more true and more useful in explaining in a simple way what is happening. My use of the word flat doesn't mean equal, as in equal incomes, and never did. It means equalizing, because the flattening forces are empowering more and more individuals today to reach farther, faster, deeper, and cheaper than ever before. And that is equalizing power and equalizing opportunity by giving so many more people the tools and ability to connect, compete, and collaborate. In my view, this flattening of the playing field is the most important thing happening in the world today. And those who get caught up in measuring globalization purely by trade statistics or as a purely economic phenomenon instead of one that affects everything from individual empowerment to culture to how hierarchical institutions operate, are missing the impact of this change. At some point, I will stop writing this book. But for now, I am just enjoying the chance to keep sharing what I am learning, and am thankful that the flattening of the world makes doing so easier than ever. Thomas L. Friedman, Washington, D.C., April 2007.
Audio Renaissance presents The World is Flat, a brief history of the 21st century, by Thomas L. Friedman. Read for you by Oliver Wyman. How the World Became Flat.
No one ever gave me directions like this on a golf course before. Aim at either Microsoft or IBM. I was standing on the first tee at the KGA Golf Club in downtown Bangalore in southern India when my playing partner pointed at two shiny glass and steel buildings off in the distance, just behind the first green. HP and Texas Instruments had their offices on the back nine, along the 10th hole. That wasn't all. The tee markers were from Epson, the printer company, and one of our caddies was wearing a hat from 3M. Outside, some of the traffic signs were also sponsored by Texas Instruments, and the Pizza Hut billboard on the way over showed a steaming pizza under the headline, Gigabytes of Taste. No, this definitely wasn't Kansas. It didn't even seem like India. Was this the new world, the old world, or the next world? I had come to Bangalore, India's Silicon Valley, on my own Columbus-like journey of exploration. Columbus sailed with the Niña, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria in an effort to discover a shorter, more direct route to India by heading west, across the Atlantic, on what he presumed to be an open sea route to the East Indies, rather than going south and east around Africa, as Portuguese explorers of his day were trying to do. He apparently assumed the Earth was round, which was why he was convinced that he could get to India by going west. He miscalculated the distance, though. He thought the Earth was a smaller sphere than it is. He also did not anticipate running into a landmass before he reached the East Indies. Nevertheless, he called the Aboriginal peoples he encountered in the New World Indians. Columbus was searching for hardware, precious metals, silk, and spices, the source of wealth in his day. I was searching for software, brain power, complex algorithms, knowledge workers, call centers, transmission protocols, breakthroughs in optical engineering, the sources of wealth in our day. Columbus was happy to make the Indians he met his slaves, a pool of free manual labor. I just wanted to understand why the Indians I met were taking our work. Why they had become such an important pool for the outsourcing of service and information technology work from America and other industrialized countries. Columbus had more than 100 men on his three ships. I had a small crew from the Discovery Times Channel that fit comfortably into two banged-up vans, with Indian drivers who drove barefoot. When I set sail, so to speak, I too assumed that the world was round. But what I encountered in the real India profoundly shook my faith in that notion. Columbus accidentally ran into America, but thought he had discovered part of India. I actually found India and thought many of the people I met there were Americans. Columbus reported to his king and queen that the world was round, and he went down in history as the man who first made this discovery. I returned home and shared my discovery only with my wife. And only in a whisper. "Honey," I confided, "I think the world is flat." I guess you could say it all started in Nandan Nilekani's conference room at Infosys Technologies Limited. Infosys is one of the jewels of the Indian information technology world, and Nilekani, the company's CEO, is one of the most thoughtful and respected captains of Indian industry. I drove with the Discovery Times crew out to the Infosys campus, about 40 minutes from the heart of Bangalore, to tour the facility and interview Nilekani. Nilekani gave our TV crew a tour of Infosys's global conferencing center, ground zero of the Indian outsourcing industry. It was a cavernous wood-paneled room that looked like a tiered classroom from an Ivy League law school. On one end was a massive wall-sized screen, and overhead there were cameras in the ceiling for teleconferencing. "So this is our conference room, probably the largest screen in Asia. This is 40 digital screens put together," Nilekani explained proudly, pointing to the biggest flat-screen TV I had ever seen. "Infosys," he said, "can hold a virtual meeting of the key players from its entire global supply chain for any project at any time on that supersized screen. so their American designers could be on the screen speaking with their Indian software writers and their Asian manufacturers all at once. Outsourcing is just one dimension of a much more fundamental thing happening today in the world, Neelakani explained. What happened over the last few years is that there was a massive investment in technology, especially in the bubble era, when hundreds of millions of dollars were invested in putting broadband connectivity around the world, undersea cables, all those things. At the same time, he added, computers became cheaper and dispersed all over the world, and there was an explosion of software, email, search engines like Google, and proprietary software that can chop up any piece of work and send one part to Boston, one part to Bangalore, and one part to Beijing, making it easy for anyone to do remote development. When all of these things suddenly came together around 2000, added Neelakani, they created a platform where intellectual work, intellectual capital, could be delivered from anywhere. It could be disaggregated, delivered, distributed, produced, and put back together again. And this gave a whole new degree of freedom to the way we do work, especially work of an intellectual nature. And what you are seeing in Bangalore today is really the culmination of all these things coming together. We were sitting on the couch outside of Neelakani's office, waiting for the TV crew to set up its cameras. At one point, summing up the implications of all this, Neelakani uttered a phrase that rang in my ear. He said to me, "Tom, the playing field is being leveled." He meant that countries like India are now able to compete for global knowledge work as never before, and that America had better get ready for this. As I left the Infosys campus that evening and bounced along the road back to Bangalore, I kept chewing on that phrase, "The playing field is being leveled." What Nandan is saying, I thought, is that the playing field is being flattened. Flattened? Flattened? My God, he's telling me the world is flat. I scribbled down four words in my notebook. The world is flat. As soon as I wrote them, I realized that this was the underlying message of everything that I had seen and heard in Bangalore in 2 weeks of filming. I wanted to drop everything and write a book that would enable me to understand how this flattening process happened and what its implications might be for countries, companies, and individuals. Let me start by taking you back to the beginning of my journey to India and other points east and share with you some of the encounters that led me to conclude that the world was no longer round, but flat. Jaithirth Jerry Rao was one of the first people I met in Bangalore, and I hadn't been with him for more than a few minutes at the Leela Palace Hotel before he told me that he could handle my tax returns and any other accounting needs I had from Bangalore. "No thanks," I demurred. "I already have an accountant in Chicago." Jerry just smiled. He was too polite to say it, that he may already be my accountant, or rather my accountant's accountant, thanks to the explosion in the outsourcing of tax preparation. "This is happening as we speak," said Rao, whose Indian firm Emphasis, spelled capital M-P-H-A-S-I capital S, has a team of Indian accountants able to do outsourced accounting work from any state in America and the federal government. "We have tied up with several small and medium-sized CPA firms in America." "You mean like my accountant?" I asked. "Yes, like your accountant," said Jerry with a smile. Jerry's company has pioneered a workflow software program with a standardized format that makes the outsourcing of tax returns cheap and easy. The whole process starts, Jerry explained, with an accountant in the United States scanning my last year's tax returns, plus my W-2, W-4, 1099, bonuses, and stock statements, everything, into a computer server, which is physically located in California or Texas. The accountants in India call up all the raw information directly from the server in America using a password, and they complete your tax returns with you remaining anonymous. All the data stays in the U.S. to comply with privacy regulations. We take data protection and privacy very seriously. In 2003, some 25,000 U.S. tax returns were done in India,
In 2004, the number was 100,000. In 2005, it is expected to be 400,000. Is this the message to Americans? Mama, don't let your kids grow up to be accountants? I asked. Not really, said Jerry. What we have done is taken the grunt work. You know what is needed to prepare a tax return? Very little creative work. This is what will move overseas. What will stay in America? I asked. The accountant who wants to stay in business in America will be the one who focuses on designing creative, complex strategies, like tax avoidance or tax sheltering, managing customer relationships, he said. He or she will say to his clients, I am getting the grunt work done efficiently, far away. Now let's talk about how we manage your estate and what you are going to do about your kids. Do you want to leave some money in your trusts? It means having the quality time discussions with clients rather than running around like chickens with their heads cut off from February to April and often filing for extensions into August because they have not had the quality time with clients. What you're telling me, I said to Jerry, is that no matter what your profession, doctor, lawyer, architect, accountant, if you are an American, you better be good at the touchy-feely service stuff, because anything that can be digitized can be outsourced to either the smartest or the cheapest producer, or both. Jerry answered, everyone has to focus on what exactly is their value add. But what if I am just an average accountant? I went to a state university. I had a B-plus average. Eventually, I got my CPA. I work in a big accounting firm doing a lot of standard work. I rarely meet with clients. They keep me in the back. But it is a decent living, and the firm is basically happy with me. What is going to happen to me in this system? It is a good question, said Jerry. We must be honest about it. We are in the middle of a big technological change. And when you live in a society that is at the cutting edge of that change, like America, it is hard to predict. It's easy to predict for someone living in India. In 10 years, we are going to be doing a lot of the stuff that is being done in America today. We can predict our future. But we are behind you. You are defining the future. America is always on the edge of the next creative wave. So it is difficult to look into the eyes of that accountant and say this is what is going to be. Any activity where we can digitize and decompose the value chain and move the work around will get moved around. Some people will say, yes, but you can't serve me a steak. True, but I can take the reservation for your table sitting anywhere in the world if the restaurant does not have an operator. We can say, yes, Mr. Friedman, we can give you a table by the window. In other words, there are parts of the whole dining out experience that we can decompose and outsource. If you go back and read the basic economics textbooks, they will tell you, goods are traded, but services are consumed and produced in the same place. And you cannot export a haircut. But we are coming close to exporting a haircut, the appointment part. What kind of haircut do you want? Which barber do you want? All those things can and will be done by a call center far away. Unlike Columbus, I didn't stop with India. By the summer of 2004, I was in Colorado on vacation. I had heard about this new low-fare airline called JetBlue, which was launched in 1999. I had heard that JetBlue had outsourced its entire reservation system to housewives in Utah, and I wanted to check this out. So I dialed JetBlue reservations and had the following conversation with the agent. Hello, this is Dolly. Can I help you? Yes, I would like to fly from Washington to Atlanta, I said. Do you fly that route? No, I'm sorry, we don't. We fly from Washington to Fort Lauderdale, said Dolly. Say, can I ask you something? Are you really at home? I read that JetBlue agents just work at home. Yes, I am. I am sitting in my office upstairs in my house, looking out the window at a beautiful sunny day. Where do you live? I asked. Salt Lake City, Utah, said Dolly. We have a two-story home, and I love working here, especially in the winter when the snow is swirling and I am up here in the office at home. David Neeleman, the founder and CEO of JetBlue Airways Corp., has a name for all this. He calls it home sourcing. A few months later, I visited Neeleman at JetBlue's headquarters in New York, and he explained to me the virtues of home sourcing, which he actually started at Morris Air, his first venture in the airline business. It was bought by Southwest. We had 250 people in their homes doing reservations at Morris Air, said Neeleman. They were 30% more productive. They take 30% more bookings by just being happier. They were more loyal, and there was less attrition. So when I started JetBlue, I said, we are going to have 100% reservation at home. Neeleman has a personal reason for wanting to do this. He is a Mormon and believes that society will be better off if more mothers are able to stay at home with their young children but are given a chance to be wage earners at the same time. So he based his home reservation system in Salt Lake City, where the vast majority of the women are Mormons and many are stay-at-home mothers. We will never outsource to India, said Neeleman. The quality we can get here is far superior. Employers are more willing to outsource to India than to their own homes, and I can't understand that. Somehow, they think that people need to be sitting in front of them or some boss they have designated. The productivity we get here more than makes up for the India wage factor. A Los Angeles Times story about JetBlue, May 9, 2004, noted that in 1997, 11.6 million employees of U.S. companies worked from home at least part of the time. Today, that number has soared to 23.5 million, 16% of the American labor force. In some eyes, home sourcing and outsourcing aren't so much competing strategies as they are different manifestations of the same thing. A relentless push by corporate America to lower costs and increase efficiency, wherever that may lead. That is exactly what I was learning on my own travels. Home sourcing to Salt Lake City and outsourcing to Bangalore were just flip sides of the same coin, sourcing. And the new thing I was also learning is the degree to which it is now possible for companies and individuals to source work anywhere. On October 3, 2004, I appeared on the CBS News Sunday morning show Face the Nation, hosted by veteran CBS correspondent Bob Schieffer. After the show that Sunday, Schieffer mentioned that the oddest thing had happened to him the week before. When he walked out of the CBS studio, a young reporter was waiting for him on the sidewalk. He politely introduced himself as a reporter for a website called NDC Journal, and asked whether he could ask Schieffer a few questions. Schieffer, being a polite fellow, said, sure. The young man interviewed him on a device Schieffer did not recognize, and then asked if he could take his picture. A picture? Schieffer noticed that the young man had no camera. He turned his cell phone around and snapped Schieffer's picture. So I came in the next morning and looked up this website, and there was my picture and the interview, and there were already 300 comments about it, said Schieffer, who, though keenly aware of online journalism, was nevertheless taken aback at the incredibly fast, low-cost, and solo manner in which this young man had put him up in lights. I was intrigued by this story, so I tracked down the young man from NDC Journal. His name is Bill Ardolino, and he is a very thoughtful guy. I conducted my own interview with him online, how else, and began by asking about what equipment he was using as a one-man network/newspaper. I used a minuscule MP3 player/digital recorder, 3.5 inches by 2 inches, to get the recording, and a separate small digital camera phone to snap his picture, said Ardolino. Not quite as sexy as an all-in-one phone/camera/recorder, which does exist, but a statement on the ubiquity and miniaturization of technology nonetheless. I carry this equipment around DC at all times because, hey, you never know. I offer the Schieffer-Ardolino encounter as just one example of how the flattening of the world has happened faster and changed rules, roles, and relationships more quickly than we could have imagined. And though I know it is a cliche, I have to say it nevertheless. You ain't seen nothing yet. As I detail in the next chapter, we are entering a phase where we are going to see the digitization, virtualization, and automation of almost everything. The gains in productivity will be staggering for those countries, companies, and individuals who can absorb the new technological tools. And we are entering a phase where more people than ever before in the history of the world are going to have access to these tools, as innovators, as collaborators, and, alas, even as terrorists. You say you want a revolution? Well, the real information revolution is about to begin. If I am right about the flattening of the world, it will be remembered as one of those fundamental changes, like the rise of the nation-state or the Industrial Revolution, each of which, in its day, noted Rothkopf, produced changes in the role of individuals, the role and form of governments, the way we innovated, the way we conducted business, the role of women, the way we fought wars, the way we educated ourselves, the way religion responded, the way art was expressed, the way science and research were conducted, not to mention the political labels we assigned to ourselves and to our opponents. If the prospect of this flattening, and all of the pressures, dislocations, and opportunities accompanying it, causes you unease about the future, you are neither alone nor wrong. Whenever civilization has gone through one of these disruptive, dislocating technological revolutions, like Gutenberg's introduction of the printing press, the whole world has changed in profound ways. But there is something about the flattening of the world that is going to be qualitatively different from other such profound changes. The speed and breadth with which it is taking hold. This flattening process is happening at warp speed and directly or indirectly touching a lot more people on the planet at once. The faster and broader this transition to a new era, the more likely is the potential for disruption, as opposed to an orderly transfer of power from the old winners to the new winners. And that is why the great challenge for our time will be to absorb these changes in ways that do not overwhelm people, but also do not leave them behind. None of this will be easy. But this is our task. It is inevitable and unavoidable. It is the ambition of this audio program to offer a framework for how to think about it and manage it to our maximum benefit. The 10 Forces That Flattened the World. This chapter is about the forces that flattened the world and the multiple new forms and tools for collaboration that this flattening has created. Flattener number 1. 11989. When the walls came down and the windows went up. The first time I saw the Berlin Wall, it already had a hole in it. It was December 1990, and I was traveling to Berlin with the reporters covering Secretary of State James A. Baker III. The Berlin Wall had been breached a year earlier, on November 9, 1989. Secretary Baker was making his first visit to see this crumbled monument to Soviet communism. I was standing next to him with a small group of reporters. After Baker finished looking through the wall and moved along, we reporters took turns peering through the same jagged concrete hole. I remember thinking how unnatural it looked. Indeed, what a bizarre thing it was, this cement wall snaking across a modern city for the sole purpose of preventing the people on the other side from enjoying, even glimpsing, freedom. The fall of the Berlin Wall on 11-9-89 unleashed forces that ultimately liberated all the captive peoples of the Soviet Empire. But it actually did so much more. It tipped the balance of power across the world toward those advocating democratic, consensual, free market-oriented governance, and away from those advocating authoritarian rule with centrally planned economies. The Cold War had been a struggle between two economic systems, capitalism and communism, and with the fall of the wall, there was only one system left, and everyone had to orient himself or herself to it one way or another. Henceforth, more and more economies would be governed from the ground up by the interests, demands, and aspirations of the people, rather than from the top down by the interests of some narrow ruling clique. Tarun Das was heading the Confederation of Indian Industry when the wall fell in Berlin, and he saw its ripple effect felt all the way to India. "We had this huge mass of regulation and controls and bureaucracy," he recalled. Nehru had come to power after the end of British colonial rule and had a huge country to manage and no experience of running a country. The U.S. was busy with Europe and Japan and the Marshall Plan. So Nehru looked north, across the Himalayas, and sent his team of economists to Moscow. They came back and said that this country, the Soviet Union, was amazing. They allocate resources, they give licenses, there is a planning commission that decides everything, and the country moves. So we took that model and forgot that we had a private sector. That private sector got put under this wall of regulation. By 1991, the private sector was there, but under wraps, and there was a mistrust about business. They made profits. The entire infrastructure from 1947 to 1991 was government-owned. The burden of state ownership almost bankrupted the country. We were not able to pay our debts. As a people, we did not have self-confidence. Sure, we might have won a couple of wars with Pakistan, but that did not give the nation confidence.
In 1991, with India running out of hard currency, Manmohan Singh, the finance minister at the time, and now the prime minister, decided that India had to open its economy.
"Our Berlin Wall fell," said Das, "and it was like unleashing a caged tiger. Trade controls were abolished. We were always at 3% growth, the so-called Hindu rate of growth, slow, cautious, conservative. To make better returns, you had to go to America. Well, 3 years later, after the 1991 reforms, we were at 7% rate of growth. To hell with poverty. Now, to make it, you could stay in India and become one of Forbes' richest people in the world. All the years of socialism and controls had taken us downhill to the point where we had only $1 billion in foreign currency. Today, we have $118 billion. We went from quiet self-confidence to outrageous ambition in a decade." The fall of the Berlin Wall didn't just help flatten the alternatives to free market capitalism and unlock enormous pent-up energies for hundreds of millions of people in places like India, Brazil, China, and the former Soviet Empire. It also paved the way for the adoption of common standards, standards on how economies should be run, on how accounting should be done, on how banking should be conducted, on how PCs should be made, and on how economics papers should be written. To put it another way, the fall of the wall enhanced the free movement of best practices. While the positive effects of the wall coming down were immediately apparent, the cause of the wall's fall was not so clear. But if I had to point to one factor as first among equals, it was the information revolution that began in the early to mid-1980s. Totalitarian systems depend on a monopoly of information and force, and too much information started to slip through the Iron Curtain, thanks to the spread of fax machines, telephones, and other modern tools of communication. A critical mass of IBM PCs and the Windows operating system that brought them to life came together in roughly this same time period that the wall fell, and their diffusion put the nail in the coffin of communism because they vastly improved horizontal communication, to the detriment of the exclusively top-down form that communism was based upon. They also greatly enhanced personal information gathering and personal empowerment. The first IBM PC hit the markets in 1981. At the same time, many computer scientists around the world had started using these things called the Internet and email. The first version of the Windows operating system shipped in 1985, and the real breakthrough version that made PCs truly user-friendly, Windows 3.0, shipped on May 22, 1990, only 6 months after the wall went down. In this same time period, some people other than scientists started to discover that if they bought a PC and a dial-up modem, they could connect their PCs to their telephones and send emails through private internet service providers like CompuServe and America Online. It was the age of Me and my machine can now talk to each other better and faster so that I personally can do more tasks. And the age of me and my machine can now talk to a few friends and some other people in my company better and faster so we can become more productive. The walls had fallen and the windows had opened, making the world much flatter than it had ever been. But the age of seamless global communication had not dawned. Though we didn't notice it, there was a discordant note in this exciting new era. It wasn't only Americans and Europeans who joined the people of the Soviet Empire in celebrating the fall of the wall and claiming credit for it. Someone else was raising a glass, not of champagne, but of thick Turkish coffee. His name was Osama bin Laden, and he had a different narrative. His view was that it was the jihadi fighters in Afghanistan, of which he was one, who had brought down the Soviet Empire by forcing the Red Army to withdraw from Afghanistan, with some help from U.S. and Pakistani forces. And once that mission had been accomplished, the Soviets completed their pullout from Afghanistan on February 15, 1989, just 9 months before the fall of the Berlin Wall. Bin Laden looked around and found that the other superpower, the United States, had a huge presence in his own native land, Saudi Arabia, the home of the two holiest cities in Islam, and he did not like it. Both Bin Laden and Ronald Reagan saw the Soviet Union as the evil empire, but Bin Laden came to see America as evil too, and he was not alone. While we were celebrating 11/9, the seeds of another memorable date, 9/11, were being sown. Flattener number 2, 8/9/95, when Netscape went public. When I sat down with Jim Barksdale, the former Netscape CEO, to interview him for this book, I explained to him that one of the early chapters was about the 10 innovations, events, and trends that had flattened the world. The first event, I told him, was 11/9, and I explained the significance of that date. Then I said, let me see if you can guess the significance of the second date, 8/9. It took Barksdale only a second to ponder that before shooting back with the right answer. The day Netscape went public. Few would argue that Barksdale is one of the great American entrepreneurs. He helped Federal Express develop its package tracking and tracing system, then moved over to Macaw Cellular, the mobile phone company, built that up, and oversaw its merger with AT&T in 1994. Just before the sale closed, he was approached by a headhunter to become the CEO of a new company called Mosaic Communications, forged by two now legendary innovators, Jim Clark and Marc Andreessen. In mid-1994, Clark, the founder of Silicon Graphics, had joined forces with Andreessen to found Mosaic, which would quickly be renamed Netscape Communications. Andreessen, a brilliant young computer scientist, had just spearheaded a small software project at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, NCSA, based at the University of Illinois, that developed the first really effective web browser, also called Mosaic. Clark and Andreessen quickly understood the huge potential for web browsing software and decided to partner up to commercialize it. As Netscape began to grow, they reached out to Barksdale for guidance and insight into how best to go public. Today, we take this browser technology for granted, but it was actually one of the most important inventions in modern history. When Andreessen was back at the University of Illinois NCSA lab, he found that he had PCs, workstations, and the basic network connectivity to move files around the internet, but it was still not very exciting, because there was nothing to browse with, no user interface to pull up and display the contents of other people's websites. So, Andreessen and his team developed the Mosaic browser, making websites viewable for any idiot, scientist, student, or grandma. Marc Andreessen did not invent the internet, but he did as much as any single person to bring it alive and popularize it. Netscape's first commercial browser, which could work on an IBM PC, an Apple Macintosh, or a Unix computer, was released in December 1994. and within a year, it completely dominated the market. You could download Netscape for free if you were in education or a nonprofit. If you were an individual, you could evaluate the software for free to your heart's content and buy it on disk if you wanted to. If you were a company, you could evaluate the software for 90 days. "We put up the Netscape browser," said Barksdale, "and people were downloading it for 3-month trials. I've never seen volume like this. For big businesses and government, it was allowing them to connect and unlock all their information. And the point-and-click system that Marc Andreessen invented allowed mere mortals to use it, not just scientists. And that made it a true revolution. And we said, this thing will just grow and grow and grow." Nothing did stop it. And that is why Netscape played another hugely important flattening role. It helped make the internet truly interoperable. In the years before the internet became commercial, explained Andreessen, scientists developed a series of open protocols meant to make everyone's email system or university computer network connect seamlessly with everyone else's, to ensure that no one had some special advantage. These mathematical-based protocols, which enabled digital devices to talk to each other, were like magical pipes that, once you adopted them for your network, made you compatible with everyone else, no matter what kind of computer they were running. These protocols were, and still are, known by their alphabet soup names, mainly FTP, HTTP, SSL, SMTP, POP, and TCP/IP. Together, they form a system for transporting data around the internet in a relatively secure manner, no matter what network your company or household has, or what computer or cell phone or handheld device you are using. As browsing and the internet in general grew, Netscape wanted to make sure that Microsoft, with its huge market dominance, would not be able to shift these web protocols from open to proprietary standards that only Microsoft servers would be able to handle. Netscape began pushing these open standards through the sale of its browsers, and the public responded enthusiastically. Sun started to do the same with its servers, and Microsoft started to do the same with Windows 95, considering browsing so critical that it famously built its own browser directly into Windows with the addition of Internet Explorer. Each realized that the public, which suddenly could not get enough of email and browsing, wanted the internet companies to work together and create one interoperable network. They wanted companies to compete with each other over different applications, that is, over what consumers could do once they were on the internet, not over how they got on the internet in the first place. As a result, after quite a few format wars among the big companies, by the late 1990s, the internet computing platform became seamlessly integrated. This integration was a huge flattener because it enabled so many more people to get connected with so many more other people. In the summer of 1995, Barksdale and his Netscape colleagues went on an old-fashioned roadshow with their investment bankers from Morgan Stanley to try to entice investors around the country to buy Netscape stock once it went public. "When we went out on the road," said Barksdale, "Morgan Stanley said the stock could sell for as high as $14, but after the roadshow got going, they were getting such demand for the stock, they decided to double the opening price to $28. The last afternoon before the offering, we were all in Maryland. It was our last stop. We had this caravan of black limousines. We looked like some kind of mafia group. We needed to be in touch with Morgan Stanley headquarters, but we were somewhere where our cell phones didn't work. So we pulled into these two filling stations across from each other, all these black limos, to use the phones. We called up Morgan Stanley, and they said, 'We're thinking of bringing it out at $31. I said, "No, let's keep it at $28, because I wanted people to remember it as a $20 stock, not a $30 stock, just in case it didn't go well. So then the next morning, I get on the conference call, and the thing opened at $71. It closed the day at $56, exactly twice the price I set. Netscape eventually fell victim to overwhelming and, the courts decided, monopolistic competitive pressure from Microsoft, Microsoft's decision to give away its browser, Internet Explorer, as part of its dominant Windows operating system, combined with its ability to throw more programmers at web browsing than Netscape, led to the increasing slippage of Netscape's market share. In the end, Netscape was sold for $10 billion to AOL, which never did much with it. But though Netscape may have been only a shooting star in commercial terms, what a star it was, and what a trail it left. "We were profitable almost from the start," said Barksdale. "Netscape was not a dot-com. We did not participate in the dot-com bubble. We started the dot-com bubble. And what a bubble it was." "Netscape going public stimulated a lot of things," said Barksdale. "The technologists loved the new technology things it could do, and the business people and regular folks got excited about how much money they could make. People saw all those young kids making money out of this and said, 'If those young kids can do this and make all that money, I can too.' Greed can be a bad thing. Folks thought they could make a lot of money without a lot of work. It certainly led to a degree of overinvestment, putting it mildly. Every sillier and sillier idea got funded." What was it that stimulated investors to believe that demand for internet usage and internet-related products would be infinite? The short answer is digitization. Once the PC Windows revolution demonstrated to everyone the value of being able to digitize information and manipulate it on computers and word processors, and once the browser brought the internet alive and made web pages sing and dance and display, everyone wanted everything digitized as much as possible so they could send it to someone else down the internet pipes. Thus began the digitization revolution. As investors watched this mad rush to digitize everything, they said to themselves, "Holy cow, if everyone wants all this stuff digitized and turned into bits transmitted over the internet, the demand for web service companies and the demand for fiber optic cables to handle all this digitized stuff around the world is going to be limitless. You cannot lose if you invest in this." And thus, the bubble was born. Overinvestment is not necessarily a bad thing, provided that it is eventually corrected. I'll always remember a news conference that Microsoft chairman Bill Gates held at the 1999 World Economic Forum in Davos at the height of the tech bubble. Over and over again, Gates was bombarded by reporters with versions of the question, "Mr. Gates, these internet stocks, they're a bubble, right? Surely they're a bubble. They must be a bubble." Gates compared the internet to the gold rush, the idea being that more money was made selling Levi's, picks, shovels, and hotel rooms to the gold diggers than from digging up gold from the earth. Gates was right. Booms and bubbles may be economically dangerous. They may end up with many people losing money and a lot of companies going bankrupt. But they also often do drive innovation faster and faster, and the sheer overcapacity that they spur, whether it is in railroad lines or automobiles, can create its own unintended positive consequences. That is what happened with the internet stock boom. It sparked a huge overinvestment in fiber optic cable companies, which then laid massive amounts of fiber optic cable on land and under the oceans, which dramatically drove down the cost of making a phone call or transmitting data anywhere in the world. It was actually the coincidence of the dot-com boom and the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that launched the fiber optic bubble. The act allowed local and long-distance companies to get into each other's businesses and enabled all sorts of new local exchange carriers to compete head-to-head with the Baby Bells and AT&T in providing both phone services and infrastructure. As these new phone companies came online, offering their own local, long-distance, international, data, and internet services, each sought to have its own infrastructure. And why not? The internet boom led everyone to assume that the demand for bandwidth to carry all that internet traffic would double every 3 months, indefinitely. For about 2 years, that was true. But then the law of large numbers started to kick in, and the pace of doubling slowed. Unfortunately, the telecom companies weren't paying close attention to the developing mismatch between demand and reality. The market was in the grip of an internet fever, and companies just kept building more and more capacity. And the stock market boom meant money was free. It was a party. So every one of these incredibly optimistic scenarios from every one of these new telecom companies got funded. In a period of about 5 or 6 years, these telecom companies invested about $1 trillion in wiring the world. And virtually no one questioned the demand projections. So when the dot-com bust came along, there was just way too much fiber optic cable out there. Long-distance phone rates went from $2 a minute to 10 cents, and transmission of data was virtually free. The telecom industry has invested itself right out of a business, Mike McHugh, Chief Operations Officer of Tell Me Networks, a voice-activated internet service, told CNetNews.com in June 2001. They've laid so much fiber in the ground that they've basically commoditized themselves. They are going to get into massive price wars with everyone, and it's going to be a disaster. It was a disaster for many of the companies and their investors. But it turned out to be a great boon for consumers. Just as the national highway system that was built in the 1950s flattened the United States, broke down regional differences, and made it so much easier for companies to relocate in lower-wage regions, like the South, because it had become so much easier to move people and goods long distances, so the laying of global fiber highways flattened the developed world. It helped to break down global regionalism, create a more seamless global commercial network, and made it simple and almost free to move digitized labor, service jobs, and knowledge work to lower-cost countries. But the fun was just beginning. This phase was just the foundation for the next step in flattening the flat world.
Flattener number 3, workflow software. Let's do lunch. Have your application talk to my application. I met Scott Hyten, the CEO of Wildbrain, a cutting-edge animation studio in San Francisco that produces films and cartoons for Disney and other major studios, at a meeting in Silicon Valley in the winter of 2004. I had been invited by John Doerr, the venture capitalist, to test out the ideas in this book to a few of the companies that he was backing. Hyten and I really hit it off, maybe because after hearing my arguments, he wrote me an email that said, "I am sure in Magellan's time there were plenty of theologians, geographers, and pundits who wanted to make the world flat again. I know the world is flat, and thank you for your support. A man after my own heart." Hyten invited me to come and watch them produce a cartoon segment to really appreciate how flat the world is, which I did. The series they were working on when I showed up was for the Disney Channel and called Higglytown Heroes. This all-American show is being produced by an all-world supply chain. The recording session, explained Hyten, is located near the artist, usually in New York or L.A. The design and direction is done in San Francisco. The writers network in from their homes, Florida, London, New York, Chicago, L.A., and San Francisco. And the animation of the characters is done in Bangalore, with edits from San Francisco. I needed to see Wildbrain firsthand because it is a graphic example of the next layer of innovation and the next flattener that broadly followed on the Berlin Wall, Windows, and Netscape phases. I call this the workflow phase. When the walls went down and the PC, Windows, and Netscape browser enabled people to connect with other people as never before, it did not take long before all these people who were connecting wanted to do more than just browse and send email, instant messages, pictures, and music over this internet platform. They wanted to shape things, design things, create things, sell things, buy things, keep track of inventories, do somebody else's taxes, and read somebody else's x-rays from half a world away. And they wanted to be able to do any of these things from anywhere to anywhere and from any computer to any computer seamlessly. But for all of us to go to the next stage, to get more out of the internet, the flattening process had to go another notch. We needed two things. We needed programmers to come along and write new applications, new software, that would enable us really to get the maximum from our computers as we worked with these digitized data, words, music, and pictures and shaped them into products. We also needed more magic pipes, more transmissions protocols that would ensure that everyone's software applications could connect with everyone else's software applications. In short, we had to go from an internet that just connected people to people and people to their own applications to an internet that could connect any of my software programs to any of your software programs. Only then could we really work together. In the late 1990s, the software industry began to respond to what its consumers wanted. Technology companies started to forge more common web-based standards, more integrated digital plumbing and protocols, so that anyone could fit his hose, his software applications, onto anyone else's hydrant. Technically, what made it possible was the development of a new data description language called XML and its related transport protocol called SOAP. XML and SOAP created the technical foundation for software program to software program interaction, which was the foundation for web-enabled workflow. They enabled digitized data, words, music, and photos to be exchanged between diverse software programs so that they could be shaped, designed, manipulated, edited, re-edited, stored, published, and transported without any regard to where people are physically sitting or what computing devices they are connecting through. Once this technical foundation was in place, more and more people started writing workflow software programs for more and more different tasks. WildBrain wanted programs to make animated films with a production team spread out around the world. Boeing wanted them so that its airplane factories in America could constantly resupply different airline customers with parts through its computer ordering systems, no matter what country those orders came from. And Mom and Dad wanted them because they wanted their e-banking software, e-brokerage software, office email, and spreadsheet software to all work off their home laptop and be able to interface with their office desktop. And once everyone's applications started to connect to everyone else's applications, which took several years and a lot of technology and brain power to make happen, work could not only flow like never before, but it could be chopped up and disaggregated like never before and sent to the four corners of the world. The vast network of underground plumbing that made it possible for all this work to flow has become quite extensive. It includes all the internet protocols of the previous era, like TCP/IP and others, which made browsing and email and websites possible. It includes newer tools, like XML and SOAP, which enabled web applications to communicate with each other more seamlessly. And it includes software agents known as middleware, which serves as an intermediary between wildly diverse applications. The nexus of these technologies has been a huge boon to innovation and a huge reducer of friction between companies and applications. Instead of everyone trying to control the fire hydrant nozzle, they made all the nozzles and hoses the same, creating a much bigger market that stretched across every neighborhood of the world. Then, companies started to compete instead over the quality of the hose, the pump, and the fire truck. That is, they competed over who could make the most useful and nifty applications, said Joel Cawley, the head of IBM's strategic planning unit. Standards don't eliminate innovation. They just allow you to focus it. They allow you to focus on where the real value lies, which is usually everything you can add above and around the standard. For workflow to reach this next stage, and the productivity enhancements it will deliver, we need more and more common standards, said IBM strategic planner Cawley. The first round of standards to emerge with the internet were around basic data. How do you represent a number? How do you organize files? How do you display and store content? And how do you share and exchange information? That was the Netscape phase. Now a whole new set of standards is emerging to enable workflow. These are standards about how we do business work together. For example, when you apply for a mortgage, go to your closing, or buy a house, there are literally dozens of processes and data flows among many different companies. One bank may handle securing your approval, checking your credit, establishing your interest rates, and handling the closing, after which the loan almost immediately is sold to a different bank. The next level of standards, added Cawley, will be about automating all these processes so they flow even more seamlessly together and can stimulate even more standards. We are already seeing standards emerging around payroll, e-commerce payment, and risk profiling, around how music and photos are digitally edited, and, most importantly, around how supply chains are connected. All of these standards, on top of the workflow software, help enable work to be broken apart, reassembled, and made to flow without friction back and forth between the most efficient producers. The diversity of applications that will automatically be able to interact with each other will be limited only by our imaginations. The gains in productivity from this could be bigger than anything we have ever seen before. Workflow platforms are enabling us to do for the service industry what Henry Ford did for manufacturing, said Jerry Rayo, the entrepreneur doing accounting work for Americans from India. We are taking apart each task and sending it around to whomever can do it best, and because we are doing it in a virtual environment, people need not be physically adjacent to each other. And then we are reassembling all the pieces back together at headquarters or some other remote site. This is not a trivial revolution. This is a major one. It allows for a boss to be somewhere and his employees to be someplace else. These workflow software platforms, Jerry added, enable you to create virtual global offices, not limited by either the boundaries of your office or your country, and to access talent sitting in different parts of the world and have them complete tasks that you need completed in real time. And so, 24/7/365, we are all working. And all this has happened in the twinkling of an eye, the span of the last 2 or 3 years. Flattener number 4, open sourcing, self-organizing collaborative communities. Alan Cohen still remembers the first time he heard the word Apache as an adult, and it wasn't while watching a Cowboys and Indians movie. It was the 1990s. The dot-com market was booming, and he was a senior manager for IBM, helping to oversee its emerging e-commerce business. I had a whole team with me and a budget of about $8 million, Cohen recalled. We were competing head-to-head with Microsoft, Netscape, Oracle, Sun, all the big boys, and we were playing this very big-stakes game for e-commerce. IBM had a huge sales force selling all this e-commerce software. One day, I asked the development director who worked for me, "Say, Jeff, walk me through the development process for these e-commerce systems. What is the underlying web server?" And he says to me, "It's built on top of Apache." And he says, "It is a shareware program for web server technology." He said it was produced for free by a bunch of geeks just working online in some kind of open source chat room. I was floored. I said, "How do you buy it?" And he says, "You download it off a website for free." And I said, "Well, who supports it if something goes wrong?" And he says, "I don't know. It just works." And that was my first exposure to Apache. Now you have to remember, back then, Microsoft, IBM, Oracle, Netscape were all trying to build commercial web servers. These were huge companies. And suddenly, my development guy is telling me that he's getting ours off the internet for free. It's like you had all these big corporate executives plotting strategies, and then suddenly the guys in the mailroom are in charge. I kept asking, "Who runs Apache? I mean, who are these guys?" "It's called the open source movement, and it involves thousands of people around the world coming together online to collaborate in writing everything from their own software to their own operating systems to their own dictionary to their own recipe for cola, building always from the bottom up rather than accepting formats or content imposed by corporate hierarchies from the top down." The word open source comes from the notion that companies or ad hoc groups would make available online the source code, the underlying programming instructions that make a piece of software work, and then let anyone who has something to contribute improve it, and let millions of others just download it for their own use for free. They do it because they want something the market doesn't offer them. They do it for the psychic buzz that comes from creating a collective product that can beat something produced by giants like Microsoft or IBM, and, even more important, to earn the respect of their intellectual peers. Indeed, these guys and gals are one of the most interesting and controversial new forms of collaboration that have been facilitated by the flat world and are flattening it even more. The intellectual commons form of open sourcing has its roots in the academic and scientific communities, where for a long time self-organized collaborative communities of scientists have come together through private networks and later the internet to pool their brain power or share insights around a particular science or math problem. The Apache web server had its roots in this form of open sourcing. Eventually, I found my way to one of their pioneers, Brian Bellendorf. If Apache, the open-source web server community, were an Indian tribe, Bellendorf would be the tribal elder. I caught up with him one day in his glass and steel office near the San Francisco airport, where he is now founder and chief technology officer of CollabNet, a startup focused on creating software for companies that want to use an open-source approach to innovation. My parents met at IBM in Southern California, and I grew up in a town just north of Pasadena, La Cañada, Bellendorf recalled. The public school was very competitive academically because a lot of the kids' parents worked at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory that was run by Caltech there. So from a very early age, I was around a lot of science in a place where it was okay to be kind of geeky. In grade school, I started doing some basic programming, and by high school I was pretty into computers. I graduated in 1991, but in 1989, in the early days of the internet, a friend gave me a copy of a program he had downloaded onto a floppy disk called Fractint. It was not pirated, but was freeware, produced by a group of programmers, and was a program for drawing fractals. When the program started up, the screen would show this scrolling list of email addresses for all the scientists and mathematicians who contributed to it. I noticed that the source code was included with the program. This was my first exposure to the concept of open source. I started to think that there were some interesting social dynamics to the way certain kinds of software were written or could be written, as opposed to the kind of image I had of the professional software developer in the back office tending to the mainframe, feeding info in and taking it out for the business. That seemed to me to be just one step above accounting and not very exciting. After graduating in 1991, Bellendorf went to Berkeley to study physics, but he quickly became frustrated by the disconnect between the abstractions he was learning in the classroom and the excitement that was starting to emerge on the internet. When you entered college back then, every student was given an email address, and I started using it to talk to students and explore discussion boards that were starting to appear around music, said Bellendorf. In 1992, I started my own internet mailing list focused on the local electronic music scene in the Bay Area. People could just post onto the discussion board, and it started to grow, and we started to discuss different music events and DJs. Then we said, "Hey, why don't we invite our own DJs and throw our own events?" It became a collective thing. Someone would say, "I have some records," and someone else would say, "I have a sound system," and someone else would say, "I know the beach, and if we showed up at midnight, we could have a party." By 1993, the internet was still just mailing lists and email and FTP sites. So I started collecting an archive of electronic music and was interested in how we could put this online and make it available to a larger audience. That was when I heard about Mosaic, the web browser developed by Marc Andreessen. So I got a job at the computer lab in the Berkeley Business School, and I spent my spare time researching Mosaic and other web technologies. That led me to a discussion board with a lot of the people who were writing the first generation of web browsers and web servers. I found myself sitting in on this forum watching Tim Berners-Lee and Marc Andreessen debating how all these things should work, recalled Bellendorf. It was pretty exciting, and it seemed radically inclusive. I didn't need a PhD or any special credentials, and I started to see some parallels between my music group and these scientists who had a common interest in building the first web software. I followed that discussion for a while, and then I told a friend of mine about it. He was one of the first employees at Wired magazine, and he said Wired would be interested in having me set up a website for them. So I joined there at $10 an hour, setting up their email and their first website, Hotwired. It was one of the first ad-supported online magazines. Hotwired decided it wanted to start by having a registration system that required passwords, a controversial concept at that time. In those days, noted Andrew Leonard, who wrote a history of Apache for Salon.com in 1997, most webmasters depended on a web server program developed at the University of Illinois' National Center for Supercomputing Applications, also the birthplace of the groundbreaking Mosaic web browser. But the NCSA web server couldn't handle password authentication on the scale that Hotwired needed. Luckily, the NCSA server was in the public domain, which meant that the source code was free to all comers. So Bellendorf exercised the hacker prerogative. He wrote some new code, a patch to the NCSA web server, that took care of the problem. Leonard commented, "He wasn't the only clever programmer rummaging through the NCSA code that winter. All across the exploding web, other webmasters were finding it necessary to take matters into their own keyboards. The original code had been left to gather virtual dust when its primary programmer, University of Illinois student Rob McCool, had been scooped up, along with Mark Andreessen and Lynx author Eric Bina, by a little-known company in Silicon Valley named Netscape. Meanwhile, the web refused to stop growing and kept creating new problems for web servers to cope with. So patches of one kind or another proliferated like band-aids on bandwidth, plugging one hole here and breaching another gap there. Meanwhile, all these patches were slowly, in an ad hoc open source manner, building a new modern web server. But everyone had his or her own version, trading patches here and there because the NCSA lab couldn't keep up with it all. I was just this near dropout, explained Bellendorf. I was having a lot of fun building this website for Wired and learning more than I was learning at Berkeley. So a discussion started in our little working group that the NCSA people were not answering our emails. We were sending in patches for the system, and they weren't responding. And we said, if NCSA would not respond to our patches, what's going to happen in the future? We were happy to continue improving this thing, yet we were worried when we were not getting any feedback and seeing our patches integrated. So I started to contact the other people I knew trading patches. Most of them were on the standards working groups, the Internet Engineering Task Force, that were setting the first standards for the interconnectivity between machines and applications on the Internet. And we said, why don't we take our future into our own hands and release our own web server version that incorporated all our patches? We looked up the copyright for the NCSA code, and it basically just said, give us credit at Illinois for what we invented if you improve it, and don't blame us if it breaks, recalled Bellendorf. So we started building our own version from all our patches. None of us had time to be a full-time web server developer, but we thought if we could combine our time and do it in a public way, we could create something better than we could buy off the shelf, and nothing was available then anyway. This was all before Netscape had shipped its first commercial web server. That was the beginning of the Apache project. By February 1999, they had completely rewritten the original NCSA program and formalized their cooperation under the name Apache. So in many ways, Bellendorf and his open-source colleagues, most of whom he had never met, but knew only by email through their open-source chat room, had created a virtual, online, bottom-up software factory, which no one owned and no one supervised. We had a software project, but the coordination and direction were an emergent behavior based on whoever showed up and wanted to write code, he said. But how does it actually work? I asked Bellendorf. You can't just have a bunch of people unmonitored throwing code together, can you? Most software development involves a source code repository and is managed by tools such as the concurrent version system, he explained. So there's a CVS server out there, and I have a CVS program on my computer. It allows me to connect to the server and pull down a copy of the code so I can start working with it and making modifications. If I think my patch is something I want to share with others, I run a program called Patch, which allows me to create a new file, a compact collection of all the changes. That is called a patch file, and I can give that file to someone else, and they can apply it to their copy of the code to see what impact that patch has. If I have the right privileges to the server, which is restricted to a tightly controlled oversight board, I can then take my patch and commit it to the repository, and it will become part of the source code. The CVS server keeps track of everything and who sent in what, so you might have read access to the repository, but not commit access to change things. When someone makes a commit to the repository, that patch file gets emailed out to all the other developers, so you get this peer review system after the fact. And if there is something wrong, you fix the bug. Because of Apache's proficiency at allowing a single server machine to host thousands of different virtual websites, music, data, text, pornography, it began to have a commanding share of the internet service provider market, noted Salons Leonard. IBM was trying to sell its own proprietary web server called Go, but it gained only a tiny sliver of the market. Apache proved to be both a better technology and free. So IBM eventually decided that if it could not beat Apache, it should join Apache. You have to stop here and imagine this. The world's biggest computer company decided that its engineers could not best the work of an ad hoc open source collection of geeks, so they threw out their own technology and decided to go with the geeks. On June 22, 1998, IBM announced plans to incorporate Apache into its own new web server product named WebSphere. The way the Apache collaborative community organized itself, whatever you took out of Apache's code and improved on, you had to give back to the whole community. But you were also free to go out and build a patented commercial product on top of the Apache code, as IBM did, provided that you included a copyright citation to Apache in your own patent. In other words, this intellectual commons approach to open sourcing encouraged people to build commercial products on top of it. While it wanted the foundation to be free and open to all, it recognized that it would remain strong and fresh if both commercial and non-commercial engineers had an incentive to participate. Today, Apache is one of the most successful open source tools, powering about two-thirds of the websites in the world. And because Apache can be downloaded for free anywhere in the world, people from Russia to South Africa to Vietnam use it to create websites. Those individuals who need or want added capabilities for their web servers can buy products like WebSphere, which attach right on top of Apache. At the time, selling a product built on top of an open source program was a risky move on IBM's part. To its credit, IBM was confident in its ability to keep producing differentiated software applications on top of the Apache vanilla. This model has since been widely adopted, after everyone saw how it propelled IBM's web server business to commercial leadership in that category of software, generating huge amounts of revenue. I like the way Irving Wolodarski Berger, IBM's Cuban-born vice president for technical strategy and innovation, summed open sourcing up. The emerging era is characterized by the collaborative innovation of many people working in gifted communities, just as innovation in the industrial era was characterized by individual genius.